Hello, I'm Angela, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 28th of August 2024.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacon. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news. As a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD, simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Reading for you this week, we have me, Angela, Helen, Mina, Simon, and Soundings contributors Roger Brooks, plus Sound Visions Jill and Bob. In this week's edition, we have the latest Beacon update from Helen. We have a top 10 teasers quiz with Roger Brooks. From the region's new super hospital, we have the latest news for the Black Country. We have all the reaction to this week's football action for West Brom and Wolves in our new fan zone feature. And we look forward to the Paralympics starting this week. There's also a focus on Esme's Umbrella, a specialist charity offering help and advice on the eye condition Charles Bonnet syndrome. Local news to start though. Hospital chiefs have at last set an opening date for the Black Country's new super hospital, built at a cost of £998 million to foster better healthcare and regeneration. The more than 700-bed Midland Metropolitan University Hospital, MMUH, in Smethwick, will throw open its doors to patients on October the 6th. It includes 11 operating theatres, purpose-built emergency department with collocated diagnostics, 15 delivery rooms for maternity services, and a midwife-led birthing unit. On October the 6th, the Samuel General Hospital's Accident and Emergency Unit will be the first department to open at the site in Grove Lane, followed by the maternity services opening on November the 6th. Winston Green City Hospital Accident and Emergency Department will relocate to the new site on November the 10th. The site had originally been due to open 6 years ago, but the project has been hit by a string of delays. Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust's chairman, Sir David Nicholson, said, "This is truly a key moment for our patients, people and population, as we know that this winter we will be delivering emergency care in an environment which exceeds expectations and delivers benefits in well-being both for patients and our staff." Our board carefully considered extensive information about all aspects of the programme to deliver the new hospital safely. We are assured of the clinical safety, patient and staff experience case for opening and transferring patients. These key milestones mark the final steps in our journey towards opening the MMUH, which is poised to become the centre of acute and emergency care at our trust. The trust said the new hospital will provide emergency, maternity, children's and adult acute inpatient services for a population of over 500,000. And amalgamate all acute and emergency care services currently situated at City Hospital and Sandwell Hospital. Both the Sandwell and City sites will continue to provide outpatients, day case and diagnostic services. Trust Chief Executive Richard Beacon said, "For many people, this has been a long time coming, so this is a significant milestone in our determination to continue to improve the life chances and health outcomes of our population." Balfour Beatty's Regional Buildings Director, Lindsay McGibbon, added, "Achieving this milestone was only made possible thanks to years of hard work and dedication from our people, who deserve a special mention for safely and successfully delivering this long-awaited transformative hospital, which will deliver significant benefits for the local community for years to come." From the opening day, the new hospital will have an urgent treatment centre, UTC, on site along those currently at Sandwell Hospital and Summerfield Primary Care Centre. UTCs provide medical help when it's not a life-threatening emergency. For example, they can provide diagnosis and treatment for ailments including sprains and strains, suspected broken bones, and stomach pain and sickness. The original opening date in 2018 was delayed by the collapse of Wolverhampton-based Fern Carillion. Balfour Beatty then took over the project. Then construction work was hit by the coronavirus pandemic. The development includes public areas including a winter garden and 80-metre-long art gallery that will be assets for the community. There will be a Sandwell Health Campus which will provide a significant extra outpatients and day case surgical capacity for the population of the Black Country in future. Rowley Regis Hospital and Leeso's Intermediate Care Centre will remain as they are, offering rehabilitation and intermediate care. The Birmingham and Midland Eye Centre, BMEC, will remain on site at the City Health Campus. Now, if you have ever had an appointment at the BMEC or any other NHS eye clinic, or even a low vision appointment at Beacon, you may have heard of or been told about the eye condition Charles Bonnet syndrome, for which symptoms include vivid hallucinations that can often be misunderstood. And Esme's Umbrella, a charity that works to raise awareness of Charles Bonnet syndrome among both visually impaired people and medical professionals. So, who are Esme's Umbrella and what help and advice do they provide? With thanks to Jill and Bob from Sound and Vision, next up we have an exclusive interview with Judith Potts, the founder of Esme's Umbrella. Should you have any concerns or wish to visit a safe place to talk about your experiences and learn about clinics which may offer reassurance and help mitigate the episodes, then please do contact Beacon's team of sight loss advisors on 01902 880 111.
Hi, I'm Bob Baker.
And I'm Jill Hardiker.
And together we are Sound and Vision,
bringing you the best information, technology and interviews for the visually impaired and those supporting them.
This time we're bringing you an amazing interview with Judith Potts, the founder and driving force behind the charity of Esme's Umbrella, supporting people with the Charles Bonnet syndrome.
These are her words, dreams and passion to highlight the charity. We started by asking her how it all began.
My mum, the Esme of Esme's Umbrella, was in her early 90s. She was very independent, lived alone, cooked for herself, looked after herself. She had glaucoma, but in those days, I knew nothing at all about any of the sight conditions. And I don't think I quite realised how much sight she had lost because she was very good at compensating. And then one day she said, I wish these people would get off my sofa. And of course, there wasn't anyone sitting on her sofa. And I thought, oh no. And I think she also thought, oh no, because the word dementia was definitely hanging in the air between us. But then I thought, no, hang on a moment. She completes correctly the Telegraph cryptic crossword every day. She cannot possibly have dementia. So I kind of took a breath, and while I was thinking how on earth I could react to this statement of hers, she said, and there is a child dressed in Edwardian costume, a little girl who follows me everywhere, and a hideous gargoyle-like creature that jumps from table to chair. And sometimes the whole room or garden morphs into an alien place. I said, well, are you all right? And she said, yes, they're my visions. I don't like them, but it's fine. I left her and I went home. And with the most enormous piece of luck, that very day, I read, buried in the health pages of one of the newspapers, a tiny paragraph about a condition which develops when you're starting to lose your sight. And it was called Charles Bonnet syndrome. And I thought, well, that's exactly what she's got. So I called her and I said, look, don't worry. I know what this is. I will call your ophthalmologist tomorrow and we'll find out what we do. And that is where it all went wrong, because her ophthalmologist refused point blank to discuss Charles Bonnet syndrome. So I was somewhat stuck. I then tried the GP, who said, well, she's obviously got dementia. I said, no, she hasn't. And we left it there. Her optometrist equally had never heard of it. And at the time, I was writing a health column for the Telegraph, which actually was about cancer after a diagnosis that I'd had. Nothing at all about sight loss. And I thought, you know, this is terrible. This is a condition that nobody seems to know about. So I did some research and I found Professor Dominic Fitch at King's College London. And I called him and said, can I come and talk to you about this? And he said, yes, of course. So I went to see him. I told him about Esme and he said, yeah, this is what she's got. And he said, please remember, this is not a mental health condition. So I thought, well, this is fascinating. So I went back to my desk and I wrote the world's first column about Charles-Bonnet syndrome. And I was inundated with emails from people who wanted to know more, who were relieved that it wasn't a mental health condition, or who wanted to tell me their story or the story of someone in their family. So in 2015, at the House of Commons with Professor Dominic Fitch, I launched Esme's Umbrella in memory of my mum and using the logo of an umbrella to shelter everyone who develops this horrific condition.
This must have been a very difficult situation to go through, with the medical fraternity not understanding or accepting her mother's condition.
But she didn't just accept it, but rather it gave her strength to do something about it, to delve further into the condition and raise awareness of this, and the fact that it's not understood or even generally known about.
So we asked Judith what her aims and ambitions were for Esme's Umbrella.
The three aims, which didn't change when we became a charity. So the first one, obviously, was to raise awareness, because people need to know, they have a right to know what is happening to them, and doctors need to know. So to raise awareness, to find ways to support people who develop the condition. And now we're looking for every sight loss charity in this country to have a champion, a CBS champion. If they can't afford to run a support group, then a champion would be great. So that's a big aim at the moment. And then thirdly, to source funding for research and try and persuade researchers that we need so much more information. And it is beginning very, very slowly. But the research that's happening is all in this country. There is no other research happening in any of the other countries in the world.
The more we speak to Judith and the more we learn about CBS, the more we're in awe of people who live with the condition, aren't we, Bob?
We are indeed, yes.
The fact that there was so little research going on is dreadful. But Judith's drive with Esme's Umbrella has changed all of that.
We asked Judith how people with CBS could get involved.
We're looking for people to volunteer for research of all types. So, as you know, research is incredibly expensive. And when I first started, Fight for Sight gave me a restricted fund. And they said, any money you are given, please put into that fund, because I wasn't a charity, so I couldn't collect it on my own. I can now. Put it in the fund and we can use it only for CBS research. So we got £12,000, which I thought was the most enormous amount of money. I became terribly excited about this. And I said, we have to advertise for researchers. Then, of course, I realized £12,000 was a tiny little drop in the ocean. So we did get a researcher, actually, and she did the first little bit looking at the difference in the brains between people who have sight loss and develop CBS against those with sight loss who don't. And we did discover that the brains of those with CBS are more excitable. But what we don't know is whether they were more excitable before, you know, were they born with excitable brains? Mm-hmm. Now we have some research happening at the Nuffield Centre for Neurosciences at Oxford University, which is fascinating. So they are sitting people under a very sophisticated scanner and watching what happens before, during and after the hallucination. The Professor Holly Bridge, who is leading this piece of research, said to me that she's pretty sure there is a chemical change. So there's a chemical being introduced into the brain before the hallucination appears. She also wondered if there was some kind of higher pathway to the pathway that I described to you. Is there an image of two being held in the we don't know. And I have no idea whether that would ever be able to be discovered. I don't know. But that's very interesting. And I think there's a lot of social research happening too. And that really only requires a telephone call. So you don't have to leave home. You don't have to sit under a scanner. But otherwise, it tends to be answering questionnaires and on the phone if you can't use a laptop. Because I'm always being asked for volunteers.
I'll tell you what I found amazing, Bob.
What's that, Jill?
Well, Judy told us that they're training dogs to sniff out when the hallucinations are about to start.
Yes, Jill, they are using dogs with the same procedure that they use for epilepsy. The dogs can recognise the change in the chemicals and the reaction in the body.
And how much development of this has taken place?
It's very much in its early stages of development, but what an amazing thing to be happening.
Yeah, let's hope they can continue with that amazing research. Anyway, Bob found out that Charles Bonnet syndrome has been a storyline in the TV series Coronation Street.
I did indeed.
So, naturally, we had to ask Judith about it.
When you managed to get it on television on Coronation Street, was that due to you being an actress that you knew people in the business?
Oh, you've done your research.
Absolutely, yeah.
Actually, it wasn't. I was approached by the scriptwriters. Somebody, I think, told them, or somebody knew a scriptwriter. You know, it's always like that, isn't it? And suggested it. And so they approached me and I said, yes, absolutely. We will help all that we can. And a lovely lady called Nina Chesworth, who's been a fantastic volunteer for me. She's a young woman. She has CBS every waking hour. So I spoke to the actor, Richard Hawley, and he then spoke to Nina. So he had an idea of what it's like to live with it. And Richard is actually patron of Esme's Umbrella now.
His portrayal of it, that went down very well. Were you in a lot of control of that? Did you have a lot
Yes,
of
I was in control of the script. It was during COVID, so I couldn't go and talk to anyone. We had to do it, you know, online. But I made sure that the script was correct. And I got Professor Fitch also to make sure that he was happy with the script. And it was very interesting because in the 3 days following the episode in which the diagnosis was revealed, the RNIB and I were contacted by 1,800 people. So we knew that we'd done a very good job there. We recently had a film made for us called Aspectum, which is a 20-minute film about two people who live with CBS. We've had audio description put on it. It's the most brilliant film, and we are about to launch it to the world.
With the use of the media, Judith has brought Esme's Umbrella and CBS to the attention of the world, and she's still looking for more ways to highlight the condition to more people.
The more people who know about the effects of Charles Bonnet syndrome and the more awareness there is about it can only be a good thing.
Jill asked Judith how Esme's Umbrella can help.
What would be your message, firstly, to people who have this condition and didn't know what it was? And secondly, how Esme's Umbrella can help them?
Well, firstly, if you discover from what I'm saying that you think you have Charles Bonnet syndrome, then I think you probably need to go to your GP with the information and say, I think this is what I've got. Just so that the GP knows and you've registered the fact that you have it. And that's actually quite useful for us because the GP's data will then, you know, add up to how many people have CBS. Professor Fitch thinks there are probably at least 1 million people in the UK. Do feel free to become a member, and I will send, and then I think I start in July, and we're going to send the sort of update of what we know and all that kind of thing out to all the members. And, well, what can I do to help? I can give you the information. I can put you in touch if you happen to have a local Esme's Friends support group, which tends to be online or on the telephone. And I can always send a full Managing CBS information pack, which has absolutely everything from why it happens all the way through to the medications that make it worse, because there are, I mean, proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole, that if you have CBS will make it worse. Right. There is luckily an alternative. For some other of the drugs, there are no alternatives, so you have to make that decision. It also talks about the medication that can be tried if the images are so horrific that you're completely disturbed and it makes your life absolutely miserable. But the problem is it's not CBS-specific medication. It's medication for dementia and epilepsy, only because for some people, it might help.
If this goes out on the Talking News Federation, there's going to be 25,000 people, some of whom I'm sure must be, you know, involved with the CBS, have it themselves or a relative or a friend. And if they wanted to be a volunteer and get in touch with you, how would they do that?
They can do that via my website or they can email me. And I'm very fortunate now because I have a young man called Luke Spink, who actually works for the Halifax Society for the Blind. But he is giving me 7 hours of his time a week. He has taken on the membership. He has taken on the social media, which is so vitally important. And he is doing an awful lot more for me, which is really fantastic. I'm enormously grateful for that.
And we're enormously grateful to Judith for talking to us.
We certainly are.
We chatted for nearly an hour, didn't we?
I know, it was amazing.
She was fascinating to talk to.
And her passion.
Yeah.
For Esme's umbrella and to try and help other people is unbelievable.
And it was really difficult to reduce what we talked about to a 15-minute slot, wasn't it, Bob?
It certainly was, yes. And I'd really like to say a massive thank you to Judith because I texted her on a Friday morning. She returned to me text with a phone call on Friday afternoon and arranged a meeting for the interview for the following Monday. It was really quite short notice.
It was, yeah. So thanks for that, Judith. So let's go through the important details now of how you can contact Judith and Esme's Umbrella for help, for information, or just for support.
Judith's email address is judith@charlesbonnetsyndrome.uk.
And the helpline for Esme's Umbrella at the RNIB is 03031 239 999, and these calls are answered by the RNIB health team, who are working in conjunction with Esme's Umbrella.
There's also a contact in the USA, and that is Gary M. Cusink. Telephone number is +1 502 43 90 398.
And all this information, along with lots of tips and ideas, as well as some great videos explaining about Charles-Bonnet syndrome, is available on the Esme's Umbrella website, which is charlesbonnetsyndrome.uk.
And finally, we would like to say a massive thank you to Judith Potts for her time and giving us the interview. We wish her and Esme's Umbrella all the very best and good luck with all the research.
So you've been listening to Sound and Vision with Bob and Jill. So until the next time.
Ta-ra a bit.
Up next, we hear from Helen, who of course has for us the Beacon Update. Hi everyone, it's Helen from Beacon here with your weekly update, and I am starting this week with some really exciting news. We are delighted to announce that the Beacon Centre now has in-post lockers on site. Whether you're picking up parcels or sending them off, our new lockers make it easier and more convenient for you to manage your deliveries while supporting our community. Located just outside our main entrance, the lockers are available 24/7, providing a safe, secure, and accessible option for everyone. And while you're here, why not make the most of your visit? You can pop into our charity shop to find some hidden treasures, enjoy a delicious coffee at the Lighthouse, or treat yourself to a haircut or massage at Verge 62 and Beauty by Claire. Every visit and purchase helps us continue our mission of empowering people with visual impairments. We can't wait to welcome you. Now, we'd like to say a huge thank you to everyone who visited our Wednesfield clearance shop on its first day of opening last week. We truly appreciate your support. If you missed out and you want to grab a bargain of your own, well, come and find us on Wednesfield's High Street. Well worth a visit, I can tell you, having been there myself. Now, next this week, our Beacon members have been getting into the Olympic spirit by creating their own medals. And let's just say we have a room full of champions. Every one of our members is a winner in our eyes. Check out our Olympic themed display. It showcases their amazing creations and gold medal worthy effort they've put in at our centre. All I can say is, go Team Beacon. Right, last this week,
Beacon Sight Loss Advisors dealt with nearly 600 referrals from people seeking support to maintain their independence last year. If you or someone you know needs guidance on living well with sight loss, we are here to help. Reach out today at 01902 880 111 or email inquiries@beaconvision.org. That's it for this week. I'll be back again soon for another update. Bye-bye.
Now it's time to test your knowledge, as we have the quiz questions for this edition. Take it away, Roger.
Roger here, with quiz called Top 10 Teasers. Okay, question 1. We hear a lot about these conferences called COP22 and COP23, etc. What does COP, C-O-P, stand for? It's very, very surprisingly bland. Question 2. In which year was the old age pension introduced in the UK? I wasn't around then. There's a clue. What was the name? Question 3. What was the name of Winston Churchill's country home? The name of Winston Churchill's country home. Question 4. James Bond films and soundtracks. Many of the James Bond films had the title of the song, the title song being the title of the film. But one of them that didn't was The Spy Who Loved Me. The theme song from that one was Nobody Does It Better. Nobody does it better. Makes me feel sad for the rest, etc. Nobody does it half as good as you. I think she should have said well as you if she was being more grammatical. But who was the female singer of Nobody Does It Better? Question 5. Food. The Americans call them scallions. Scallions with a C. With SC. What do we call them? Okay. Question 6. What is ophidiophobia? Ophidiophobia. O-P-H-I-D-I-O-P-H-O-B-I-A. It's a fear of what? Question 7. Literature. Who wrote the book Cider with Rosie? Cider with Rosie. Question 8. What is the core ingredient of gin? There are so many varieties these days. Gin with Coca-Cola, gin with chips, and gin with orange juice, and other exotic means of extracting even more money from gin drinkers. What's the core ingredient of gin? Question 9. Name the 4 character names of the people in The Good Life. 2 couples, sometimes at war, sometimes friendly, sometimes even more than friendly. Can you name them? And question 10. Who is the only woman ever to win 2 Nobel Prizes?
Now, with the 2024 Paralympics starting this week, we'll hear from New Soundings contributors Jill and Bob again as they talk to a visually impaired Paralympian and make suggestions for sports that could give you a new pastime and help keep you fit, as a visual impairment shouldn't hold anyone back.
Hi, I'm Bob Baker.
And I'm Jill Hardiker.
And together we are Sound and Vision,
bringing you the best information, technology and interviews for the visually impaired and those supporting them.
With this being an Olympic and Paralympic year, let's have a chat about sport.
Ooh, yes, let's. It's not all about being an Olympic athlete, you know, or an elite athlete. You can get involved with sport at any level, and we've got some great ideas and information for you later on.
This time the Olympics are in Paris, France. Based around the Stade de France, at the Eiffel Tower and various locations around Paris. And the Paralympics start on August the 30th.
So let's concentrate on the Paralympics, where there are around 164 events taking place. 90 for men, 74 for women, and a mixed event.
That's a whole lot of activity going on in such a short space.
It is.
There are about 10 areas of sport for the visually impaired athletes. So let's have a look at some of the sports, Jill.
Okay, shall we start with cycling?
We shall.
A short time ago, we had the pleasure of a chat with New Zealand British Paralympic cyclist Steve Bate, MBE, who competes in tandem races as an athlete with a visual impairment. So he explained about his diagnosis and how it affected him and how he became a gold-winning Paralympian.
So for me, it was a bit of a surprise, really, finding out that I had retinitis pigmentosa. I was working for an outdoor charity working with disadvantaged young children in the north of Scotland. And we decided as a group of instructors, it'd be a really good idea to have our eyes tested once a year. And I knew that I had an issue with my eyesight, like in the dark, really, mainly I struggled walking out of like winter climbing and things like that. I trip over things and stuff. So I knew there wasn't something quite right. You know, I went in for a standard eye check and, you know, I could still read the very bottom line off the eye chart. So, you know, my macular vision was still really good. Lloyd, the optometrist, said, oh, you've got 20/20 vision. Great. And, you know, I just made a passing comment, said, well, it's bizarre there because, you know, like I really can't see in the dark that well. You know, if I drop my keys on the floor at my feet, sometimes it takes me a while to actually see where they are to pick them up. So I went on the visual field test, and of course, that exposed that I had absolutely zero peripheral vision. They were straight back into Lloyd's office saying, oh, you need to see this. Yeah, and I remember Lloyd saying, there's a big issue here. Have you got someone who can come and collect you? Because I don't think you should ever drive a car again. God, how old was I? 34, maybe? Fiercely independent male, drove everywhere and, you know, was fit and healthy. Worked as an outdoor instructor. At that point in my life, I was trying to be an alpine guide, you know, trying to guide people in the Himalayas and stuff. That's what I was working towards. And all of a sudden, that looked like there was a big question mark around that. This was going to be my life moving forward, you know, not being able to drive. And certainly guiding in the mountains was, that's going to be impossible. Like, I can't do that. What I knew as my life, you know, this great adventure and being in the mountains and climbing and doing all this fun stuff, I just couldn't see how that was possible. So I really struggled for about 6 months to work out how on earth I was going to carry on. You know, I had everyone around me going, don't worry, it'll be fine, you'll work it out. But at the time when I was going through that, none of them had gone through anything like this. So at that point, I was searching for someone basically to tell me everything was going to be okay. The criteria of that was they've had to have had some sort of big ordeal in their life. And that person came with a friend of Karen Dar, who had a climbing accident at 21 years old, broke her back in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. So I spoke to Karen. She said, you know, hey, you know, great, you're going blind, you can race on the back of a tandem and race for Great Britain. Of course, at that time, I was like, no, Karen, you don't understand, I can't do any of this stuff anymore. And she kind of palmed off and just said, get a grip of yourself, mate. You know, you've got to move forward. And the sooner you do that, the better. I mean, I guess at the time that was pretty hard to hear, but she was bang on right. And I guess I came away from that, yeah, with a different outlook, you know, like, hey, okay, Karen says it's going to be okay. It's probably going to be okay. For me, the first thing I did was got back to climbing because, you know, I'd stopped climbing for kind of 4 or 5 months thinking that that wasn't possible. The true thing, I think, that unlocked everything and made me realize my potential was going to El Capitan and soloing El Capitan. When I topped out on LCAP, the self-confidence that gave me was incredible. And like I say, Karen planted that seed of cycling in my head. And, you know, at that point, I think it was about 2.5 years away from the Paralympics in Rio. And I thought, wow, I mean, imagine going to a Paralympics when you've never been an athlete in your life. I went on what's called a talent ID day, where people can come along and try out, jump on a bike and see if you can produce, you know, enough power and try and find people to, you know, take up the sport and represent the country. In January 2014, I was brought on to the podium program for British Cycling as a full-time athlete. You know, you have to prove you can compete at the highest level. Adam, who I rode with, my site pilot on the tandem, we worked incredibly well together. You know, we were relentless for 2.5 years. It was never guaranteed that I'd ever go to a Paralympics without, you know, probably the hardest work of my life, I think.
And all their hard work paid off as they won 2 gold medals and set a world record.
That's good.
Absolutely amazing. He has recently been named for the squad in the Paris Paralympics. So once again, he has chance of winning more golds in Paris. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we wish him well for that.
Yeah, we do. Right, let's have a look at swimming. Can you swim in a straight line? Because I can't, Jill.
Well, I used to do backstroke, so I used to lie on my back and watch the lights in the ceiling to keep me in line.
Different things work for different people.
Absolutely.
<don't they>? That's great, but how do visually impaired swimmers manage to swim in a straight line?
Well, I'm told it's down to practice, practice, and more practice, which is always the case with these things. And even then, it's still possible to veer off course.
They say the attempt to keep straight by always training with symmetry in mind, both in and out of the water. Basically, that means they want both sides of the body with the same strength, so they don't veer off one way because they're stronger on one side than the other.
Yeah, and that makes them work equally, doesn't it? But some swimmers drag their fingers across the surface of the water so that if they do veer off course toward the lane line, they can hopefully detect the lane line with their fingers, which would allow them to correct their course before they crash or lose precious time, which is when you're swimming competitively is most important.
That's a great idea with the fingers. So they manage to keep straight and they got to the end of the pool. How do they know when to turn?
Well, now this is an interesting one because they have what's called a tapper who has a long pole and lets the swimmer know when they're approaching the end of the pool by tapping them either once or twice. Some people like to be tapped on the back, but some people like to be tapped on the head.
Okay, so once they've been tapped, they just spin round and go back the other way.
Exactly.
Changing the sport. You had a great experience in 2012 Paralympics in London, didn't you, Jill?
Oh, Bob, yeah, I did. I went to an athletics event in the Olympic Stadium and, amongst other events, watched the visually impaired long jump.
And whereabouts were you seated in the stadium, Jill?
Well, we were right in front of the sand pit where they jump, and it was amazing to watch how it all took place.
That's an amazing place to see the event.
Oh, we got such a good view. Each athlete came out with their coach and they went and sat on benches. And when it was time for them to compete, the coach took them to the start of the run-up. And as he did so, the announcer said the name of the athlete and then he asked for silence.
Silence? Why would they need silence?
Well, we wondered that, but then it became obvious because the stadium went quiet. And as it did, the coach started clapping slowly and the athlete started to run, getting faster and faster as the coach clapped faster and faster. And as the athlete approached the board to jump, the coach stopped clapping, so the athlete knew when to jump.
And I presume then the stadium just erupted.
Absolutely, yeah. Once they jumped, everybody started to cheer. It was a wonderful thing to see. And the coach then walked to collect the athlete from the other end of the jump and took him back to the benches for the next person to have a go.
That's absolutely amazing. Must have been a great time.
Oh, it was brilliant.
So if you're not an Olympic athlete and you're built for comfort and not for speed like me.
Yeah.
There's a massive amount of sports you can get involved with.
Yeah, there is. And a great place to start would be British Blind Sport, BBS, which is a charity that works across the UK to ensure that people with sight loss have the same opportunities as sighted people to access and enjoy sport and physical activity.
They work closely with leisure centres, clubs, national governing bodies to increase opportunities for people who are blind or partially sighted through being involved in sports. Raising awareness for sight loss across the sports sector, improving accessibility across sports venues and encouraging more people with sight loss to get involved with sport.
And BBS have an activity finder, so whether you're already active and looking for new challenges or you want to get active and don't know where to start, this is a fabulous resource for you. Find out what sports and physical activities are available in your area by using the activity finder.
We went on their website and looked at the Get Active section, which then linked us to the A to Z of Sport, which has 44 different great activities to get involved with.
So, are you ready, Bob?
I'm trying.
Here's your rundown. Angling, archery, athletics.
Baseball, blind football and boccia.
Bowls, canoeing and chess.
Climbing, cricket and curling.
Cycling, equestrian events and exercise classes.
Goalball, golf and gym and health club.
Gymnastics, ice hockey, ice skating.
Judo, karate and kayaking.
Mixed martial arts, open water swimming and para powerlifting. That's not easy to say.
No, it's not easy to do either. Partially sighted football, reformer pilates and rowing.
Running, sailing and shooting.
Showdown, skiing and snooker.
Snowboarding, swimming and taekwondo.
Bowling, tennis and triathlon.
Visually impaired rugby and walking. And well, when you've I'm done about, all of that...
I'm about worn out, just running through them.
Absolutely.
But there's such a selection.
Yeah.
How about starting with a nice walk to relax?
That's a good idea. You can go as far as you like, as fast as you like, or as slow as you like to start with, and it's easy, accessible, and cost-effective. Joining a local walking group can also help you meet new people, and it's a great activity to improve your health and fitness, as well as your mental well-being.
I love being out, having a walk in the fresh air.
Yeah.
But if it's absolutely throwing it down, how about a game of chess?
Oh, yes, that sounds more like me.
The Braille Chess Association currently support over 150 visually impaired players and learners and have over 70 members without a visually impairment to assist in a variety of ways. They play with pieces that have pegs to fit in the board, with the black section being higher than the white section.
But if being energetic is what you crave, then how about visually impaired football?
It's five-a-side played on a solid surface, surrounded by boards to keep the ball in play. The goalkeeper is sighted or partially sighted, and it's played in two halves, each of 20 minutes.
The goalkeeper helps to organise the defence, and the coach behind the attacking goal directs the forward players. When a player's about to make a tackle, they shout,
"Voi!"
And the ball is equipped with a noise-making device.
Let's go to the pool.
Oh, right.
Swimming can be an excellent sport for individuals who are blind or have low vision. Swimming for exercise can be achieved by swimming exercises, water aerobics, and laps of swimming. It's also about having fun too. Maybe just splashing about in the shallow end. I love doing that.
But any local public swimming pool should be able to make adequate adaptations for you to swim recreationally in the public sessions. And if you want to get involved in swimming, call ahead to your local leisure centre to make them aware of your visual impairment. Also, alert the lifeguard so they can make any necessary changes to fully assist you with your independence. There are many swimming clubs that are included exclusive to individuals who are blind or partially sighted, and swimming with a club allows you to improve your technique and enter competitions if you want to. It's also a great way of meeting other people.
We hope this has given you an insight in some of the sports in the Paralympics and some of the sports that you can get involved with yourselves. Not only is it good for health, but being involved in sport can help confidence in other areas of life.
Yes, it can. And if you want to find out more, the website for British Blind Sport is britishblindsport.org.uk. I'll spell that one out for you. It's britishblindsport.org.uk.
A big thanks to Steve Bate for telling us his story, and we wish him all the very best in the future.
And particularly in Paris.
Yeah, let's hope he does really well, along with all the other of the athletes as well.
Thank you for listening to Sound and Vision with Bob and Jill. So until the next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
I think it's time for us all to enjoy a good old book review. The following book is available from Calibre, an organisation which provides a free service to visually impaired people. Extracts from the audiobook also come courtesy of Calibre. So grab yourself a cuppa, find your comfy spot and nestle down, as coming up next is a discussion and review about the audio version of Beryl Bainbridge's Crimean War novel, Master Georgie.
Dame Beryl Margaret Bainbridge is a wonderful name, and she was something of a wonderful character. I say was because she died in 2010, having been born 77 years before that. Now, she's been described by, I think it was the Times that named her on the list of the 50 greatest British writers since 1945. Now, I don't know if that's enough to kill a writer or whether it's encouraging. She was an interesting character because she started out aiming to be an actor, and she was actually in Coronation Street for one performance. But she got into writing, and that's what really carried her through. And she got a special Booker Prize for being the most second placed in the Booker competition. She was put up five times and didn't win it. So in the end, they gave her a special Booker Prize. I remember reading some of the early ones, and she was, you know, great fun and was really on the edge of being quite rude and...
gritty, I think we said.
Yes.
Yes.
Because this is Debbie Heath with me again, and she and I are going to discuss this, and I've gone on far too long at the beginning. But anyway, that's the background. She was a dame, and she came from the hard streets of Liverpool. And as Debbie reminded me just now, she would turn up at plenty of parties in Liverpool, including those held by the Beatles and various other musicians of the time. Debbie, what comes across to you when you get to this woman?
I've got a theatrical background, so one of the reasons I have liked the things of hers that I've read before is that I feel, although they are obviously novels, they have a theatrical quality. I think the characters really do come alive. I loved An Awfully Big Adventure, which was made into a super film with Alan Rickman and Hugh Grant. And I suppose that drew on Bainbridge's early experiences in the theatre, probably being preyed on by these older men who promised her favours and things like that. The dressmaker I found very haunting, and that was more of a sort of mystery. So when you suggested this one, I thought, yes, I know I like the author. That's a great idea. And I knew very little about the Crimean War. So, you know, I found out a lot of new things. And I also found out that her style changed enormously over a period of about, I suppose, 30 years, maybe 20. She did seem to go for the historical novels.
Are you about to say the number of characters?
Yeah, so we've got three characters. We have the young Myrtle, who was an orphan, and she was adopted into a very wealthy family. And the son of the wealthy family, George, is our hero. Yes, he is. He is sort of a hero, anti-hero. And they meet Pompey Jones, who is a sort of street urchin, and Dr. Potter. Now, they all come together in trying to mask a big scandal. So they're quite unlikely people who would meet, but nevertheless they do. And the story develops from there, and it's a book with six long chapters, and they have two each.
There are these three characters, and the fourth is what it's all about, as it were, him, that they relate to and they play off and they talk about and they describe. And as you say, there are six chapters and they get two each. Mm. Myrtle has the first one, Pompey Jones has the second, Dr. Potter has the third, and then there are three more chapters, again narrated by those three characters. Each of the chapters explores the character of the person who's talking, because Myrtle, for instance, talks about her experience as an orphan, as a foundling. She was even worse than an orphan. She was expecting to go into a foundling hospital, and then she was taken by this family. What I found particularly interesting was the nature of the individuals who are narrating. It comes across in the language they use and in what they say and how they describe it. Let's just listen to one as a starter. This is Myrtle, the foundling.
I was 12 years old the first time Master Georgie ordered me to stand stock still and not blink. My head was on a level with the pillow, and he had me rest my hand on Mr. Hardy's shoulder. A fingertip chill struck through the cloth of his white cotton shirt. It was a Saturday, the Feast of the Assumption, and to stop my eyelids from fluttering, I pretended God would strike me blind if I let them, which is why I ended up looking so startled. Mr. Hardy didn't have to be told to keep still, because he was dead.
After being adopted, Myrtle was brought up really as one of the family. She wasn't treated as a servant. They sent her to finishing school. And one section that I really enjoyed is where she explains why she always has to have dinner before she goes out to dinner, because her table manners are just so appalling.
I don't mind doing the washing. It gives me pleasure to swill the dirt from Georgie's shirt. That evening, he insisted we took dinner together, which was his way of saying he was sorry for his earlier brusqueness. He doesn't usually relish eating with me on account of my failure to disguise appetite. The boarding school I was sent to taught me the right cutlery to use, yet failed to instill what he calls the correct attitude to the table. At home, if I'm invited out with him and Annie, he insists I eat before we go, as I haven't the knack of picking at food, possibly because I went so short of it in earlier days.
The three characters, as you say, there's the foundling or the orphan, the foundling. Pompey Jones is a fire eater. He's also not averse to nicking things. He's streetwise.
Yes, absolutely. There are various relationships between these characters which develop as time goes on. Georgie has not treated Myrtle particularly kindly in terms of his effect on her emotions, certainly.
And she's certainly infatuated by him. She'll follow him anywhere. As we see, they all go off together in the second part of the book, as where they're all heading to. The second character, the second narrator, Pompey Jones, as I said, he was not averse to nicking things, but he also played games. And that also tells you something about his character.
Oh, I love Pompey. He's my favourite character. Bit of a geezer, bit of a joker.
And I stole through the dark yard, past the stables and outhouses, and lifted the latch of the kitchen door. I took my boots off before I stepped inside. It wasn't the first time I'd been in the house without anyone guessing. I did no harm, at least not of the lasting sort, and I didn't thieve. That would have been foolish and against my own interests. Nor did I ever venture above the ground floor. What I did on my dawn perambulations through the parlour, the dining room, and the study was in the nature of an experiment. I moved things around and waited to see who noticed. I'd begun in a small way, changing the poker from right to left in the grate, shifting a vase from the front to the back of the mantel shelf, altering the order of the musical boxes on the piano top. Then, after a few months, I became bolder and swapped the pictures from one wall to another. It took 5 weeks for Dr. Potter to spot that the painting of ships in the river, previously situated behind the desk in the study, now hung beside the door. The resulting rumpus, reported to me below stairs, was all I could have wished for.
I really liked his point of view, because there was nothing stuffy about it. Dr. Potter is harder to like, really, isn't he?
It was a sort of Dickensian professorial character. Yeah. You can almost hear the commas going in his brain as he says, as I would have said, comma.
Yes.
And you can sense that in the language, the way he speaks.
The Cambria was crowded to the extent that we wallowed below the waterline, there being 200 troopers on board, 4 engineers, a veterinary surgeon, and a representative of the Liverpool Board of Commerce, sent out to see what supplies might most be in need of urgent shipment should war commence. It is the patriotic duty of the citizens of Liverpool, this gentleman informed me at the first opportunity, to make whatever sacrifice is necessary in support of our army. His name was Norton, and a more odious and obsequious individual could not be imagined. I had several heated conversations with him during the course of the voyage, and formed the opinion that profit rather than patriotism ignited his sense of duty. We were fortunate in the weather on the first leg of our journey to Malta. Nothing of note happened in the first 3 days, save for the ship's collie producing 8 pups. Myrtle insisted on earmarking one, the runt of the litter, for the children. It would be good for them, she declared, to be responsible for something small and helpless. That same afternoon, a so-called wife of one of the troopers gave birth to an infant daughter. Thankfully, it died 3 hours later, else Myrtle might have added it to our list of dependents.
Again, this comes back to the theatrical undertones, doesn't it? You really can hear him speak. If you can hear him think, it's amazing as well. So, yeah, these three very well-defined characters are used. Now, as a listener, I did not pick up on the fact that each of the 6 chapters is supposed to represent a photograph.
Any novelist writing about a historical fact will have done research, and I'm certain she came across the great photographer of the 19th century, Fenton. I cannot remember his first name for the moment, but I remember his name was Fenton, and he was the first war photographer. Now, he went out to the Crimea War, 1850s, and he took photographs not of action, battle action, and not of dead bodies, but of soldiers standing, portraits almost. And that was the first time that people back home, because it had been artists who drew what they saw.
Or did they actually draw what they saw?
draw what they were supposed to see. But even so, I say he wasn't photographing the action, he was photographing these. But it showed much more of the grit, the unpleasantness, the dirt, the pain of war, because you would have seen things like bandages and hospital wagons.
Yeah, but not so much that no. They could no longer recruit people, I suppose.
That's right. But anyway, the photography is relevant because George, who is a surgeon.
He's a surgeon by profession, but he's an amateur photographer, that's isn't right. he?
And so he combines those two, and his aim is to go out to the Crimea War to do both jobs. I mean, he does both jobs. He's trying to take photographs at the same time as he's trying to be a surgeon, as we know from Florence Nightingale, etc. It was a pretty horrendous situation, and a surgeon would have been much needed. And that's where the book leads us, the story leads us, the journey out there, the stop at Constantinople, as it was then called, Istanbul, the route out to the place called Crimea, about which we now know a great deal more, because of course it's right at the heart of the current war in the Ukraine. Some critics suggest that having three narrators, which is not unusual, but it's a very good and interesting way to create characters, because they, to some extent, play off against each other, but they also describe events in slightly different ways, because no two of us ever experience the same
things
about the situation that we are in.
And it's really like looking at a photograph, isn't it? This is a photograph that they are describing, but they see it different ways. And the other advantage is, of course, if you don't particularly like one narrator, you won't have to wait long till there's someone else. It's a structure I really like in a book, like The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. I love the way that narration skips about. But I think it's got the added significance here, hasn't it, of the photograph and people interpreting what they see in different ways and what is truth. Because, of course, the photographer wouldn't be photographing, as you said, the real action. So, you know, you could write a great essay on this, couldn't you? A-level English literature. There's a lot that you could say, but we don't have time for that. And it's a long time since I did A-level English literature, so I don't think I could anyway.
Me even more so. And as we said, it takes us into the Crimean War, and we're not going to go into that section because that is really should be left to the listener to enjoy without knowing what's going to happen. And there are various things that happen, obviously, but it is a war. War is nasty. War is unpleasant. War is violent. And she doesn't pull her punches in many ways. And it takes us from the back streets of Liverpool out to Sebastopol and Inkerman and these other famous great names of the Crimean War. I mean, it was a dreadful war. It was one of the worst wars.
Yeah, supposed to be one of the bloodiest.
I refer to Florence Nightingale as sort of, that's what the picture we get, is this wonderful woman going out there setting up nursing. But I mean, she walked into hell. It was hell on earth.
Yes, indeed. And some of the other characters, the secondary characters, they don't get much further than the boat. The journey section really stuck with me. And I thought, yes, I probably would have been like those women and just wanted to go home. This would not work out for me.
Because in the charge of the Light Brigade, the troops were followed by the cavalcade of wagons, which brought the women, the wives, the mistresses, the hangers-on, the prostitutes, the cooks, everybody, all came behind the army. Disease was rampant, and it was not a good thing to do.
So, I mean, this is a really relevant book for us to have read at this point because of the links to the current war and disease. We've got still got COVID, haven't we? So it's a really interesting time to read the book.
I hope we make it sound fun as well as that last bit about the war, as it were. But it actually has got some characters that are just wonderful to explore.
Yes, absolutely. So I suppose if I was giving the reader three reasons why they should pick it up, one, I would say, well, it's short. And like me, when you listen to audiobooks, if you don't have, well, actually, it's not just people who are sight impaired. Lots of people now choose to listen to audiobooks. You're investing a lot of time in something that's 20 hours long. This was 6 hours, and it's just so beautifully written. It's not a sketch. It's a really well-developed character piece. So that's our second point. The characterization is superb. And the third point is you just might find out something you didn't know about the Crimean War.
As you said, it's 6 hours long. The recording is by Nancy Clegg for Calibre. They have a couple of other novels by Beryl Bainbridge, Every Man for Himself, which is based on the Titanic, and one that Debbie mentioned a couple of times, An Awfully Big Adventure, which is one that I remember reading with great pleasure. And it's about the theatre, and it's about actors, and it's, again, full of characters, full of fun, as well as serious
intent.
She does
have, isn't it extraordinary that you can find fun in one of the most unpleasant war situations? She's very skilled, and she doesn't take the mickey out of it either. It's just that in everyday life, there are funny things that happen, and that's what keeps you going.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
TNS Soundings.
It has been an unforgettable weekend for our football teams this week, with the Baggies 2-1 victory taking them up to fourth place in the Championship, thanks to Josh Madger's fourth goal of the season, and for Wolves, an enthralling first half of four goals that left honours even at two apiece was all undone by a second half capitulation and defensive disarray, allowing Chelsea the freedom of the City to rack up four more goals in just 14 minutes and complete a 6-2 thrashing. Did you catch any of the action? What were your thoughts? Don't forget you can now get involved with the football roundup here on The Talking News by simply leaving a WhatsApp voice note or a voicemail on 07849 802 703. So, without further ado, let's head over to this week's Fan Zone and get our prized pundit's take on what unfolded over the weekend.
Hello, this is Wolves fan Jamie. After Wolves 2, Chelsea 6, I don't know why they keep on playing a back four. I think they should play a back three. And this is the annual back four experiment come crashing down. And I do hope they do bring some more players in, because it's obviously needed. And we need to bring in at least a defender and a winger to replace those who have gone. And it was a pretty miserable afternoon. We competed well in the first half, going in at 2-2 at half-time. And we then went and capitulated in the second half after a free kick. That was obviously disputed, and we just conceded four goals in a very short space of time.
Now we have the quiz
answers
for this edition. Take it away, Roger.
Hello, Roger, back with our top 10 teasers. And this time it's the answers. Question 1. What do the letters COP stand for, with COP this and COP that, COP 26? Because they seem to be numbered fairly randomly in increasing numbers. COP. It's the world leaders all getting together to announce great things, a wish list that, too cynical, aren't I, for this job? Anyway, it stands for Conference of the Parties. Conference of the Parties. It's not people deciding who to invite to their New Year's Eve bash. It's a Conference of the Parties, COP. Another acronym, OAP. When was the old age pension introduced? It was 1908. 1908. Been around a long time. Question 3. What was the name of Winston Churchill's country retreat? Spit it out. Retreat. It was Chartwell. Chartwell. Question 4. Who sang Nobody Does It Better? That was Carly Simon. Carly Simon. One time Mrs. James Taylor, and famous for her hit, You're So Vain. Question 5. What do the Americans call, they call it scallions, what do we call them? Well, we call them spring onions. Spring onions. Question 6 would appeal not to celebrities, get me out of here, because it is fear of snakes. Ophidiophobia, a fear of snakes. One I reckon 99.9% of the population share. Question 7. Who wrote the book Cider with Rosie. That was Laurie Lee. Laurie Lee. Question 8. Core ingredient of gin is the humble juniper berry. Juniper berries. Question 9. You can pick the bones out of this one. Characters were the Goods. That was Tom Good, played by Richard Briers. Barbara Good, played by Felicity Kendall. Margot and Jerry Ledbetter, played by Penelope Keith and Paul Eddington. So there's about 8 points to be had for that one. I'm sure you got at least 9. And question 10, who was the only woman to win 2 Nobel Prizes? That was Marie Curie, French lady Marie Curie. She was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1903 for physics and in 1911 for chemistry.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!